Well, that's our familiar theme, the old mole theme. And this is your Old Mole Variety Hour, trying to do our part to expose those who exploit and degrade others and who destroy the earth. And we cover the movements that are challenging our sick system of endless exponential growth and challenging a system that creates vast wealth for some and grinding poverty for others. And those movements are not just challenging, they are also building real operating alternatives in every life sphere, not just the workplace, but child rearing, even the foods we eat, alternatives that are democratic and sustainable, and they're all components of the necessary and possible and better world. Today on The Old Mole, we examine Trump, his sexism, racism, and why it was effective. Also today, public education, its enemies, and why, despite its great problems, why it remains one of the great achievements of working people. Also a review of the novel, A Sudden Light. It offers some inspiration and hope in these darkening times. Later today, a conversation, a riff, featuring Fred Hampton and Boots Riley, who's the Oakland well-known hip-hop artist. Also, a discussion of the relation between punk music scene of the 80s and the left folk singers of the 60s and 70s. It begins with the first verse of Phil Oakes' wonderful song, Love Me, I'm a Liberal. First Phil Oakes, and then Jan Hocken interviews psychoanalyst Jill Gentile on Trump.
I cried when they shot Medgar Evers. Tears ran down my spine, and I cried when they shot Mr. Kennedy, as though I'd lost a father of mine. But Malcolm X got what was coming, he got what he asked for this time. So love me, love me, love me, I'm a liberal.
Welcome to KBOO, Jill Gentile.
Hi there, Jan.
Well, it's good to have you here. Jill Gentile is on the faculty of the NYU postdoctoral program in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis and author with Michael McCrone of Feminine Law, Freud, Free Speech, and the Voice of Desire, and has written recently about Trump and social pathology. Well, Jill, this is President's Day, so let's talk about the president. Psychoanalysis focuses on infantile conflicts, unconscious fantasies and defenses, all of which seem pretty applicable to this guy who seems to display so much of the infantile side of power. But as a feminist and psychoanalyst, you have a different take on what is disturbing about Trump. So let's start by talking a bit about how we might make use of psychoanalysis to explain political discourse, including some of what you've taken up in your recent work.
Sure. I mean, that's a really broad question because I think psychoanalysis offers a lens that the public can really benefit from hearing. We work all the time with ideas of motivation and unconscious fantasy, and these operated in this campaign in Trump's campaign and in his presidency in ways that continue to elude conventional political analysis. When we think about Trump's appeal, a lot of analyses have explored the economic factors, the racial factors, the fear of losing one's place amongst white Americans. And a lot of these analyses have kind of revealed that race was a decisive factor. And it was Trump's uncanny wisdom, we might say, to exploit the race card, to explicitly name what remained unnamed that was percolating beneath the surface. And he did this in this way that, from a psychoanalytic perspective, was quite brilliant. He tied that to what he understood on an apparently deep level to be the vulnerability among men, especially, to feeling disenfranchised and culturally marginalized, and the threats in the culture as we shift towards a multicultural society, to feeling marginalized and to having white male supremacy threatened. And so not only did we see him develop this kind of cult of white strong men, by who he brought into his cabinet and who he formed alliances with, but he overtly derided black and brown immigrants, citizens, and degraded others, and appealed to this fantasy of supremacy, right, of omnipotence, of not needing to concede to laws, to what we conventionally and amongst the liberal elite regard as the ethical imperatives of inclusivity, equality, civil discourse in our society. So he took advantage of this vulnerability, this fear of losing one's place that authors like J.D. Vance and Arlie Hochschild have revealed was so widely featured in the subjective narratives that they documented.
So one way, I think the most commonly accessible way of understanding the dynamics of Trump's appeal is through this idea of displacement and projection, that the disturbing aspect of one's world become projected onto the outside, and then the leader becomes the border guard, the one who protects the public from threats from without. And that has a long history of building the more anxiety people feel, often the more vulnerable they are to building rigid walls and borders, both concretely real and imagined. But you've described something that is, on one level, it's very much on the surface how this is a different kind of patriarch than we've had in the past, in that he's, in some ways, he's what you might call a very regressed character. He seems out of control. It's a lot about his eating and his habits that don't display discipline. And so he's not, in a way, a very reassuring patriarch in the old school fashion. There's something so notably undisciplined about him. So what's your take on this particular appeal to power? Because on one level, there's so much on display that belies the traditional image of the reassuring patriarch with which men can identify and derive some secondary power.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. Some would say that the appeal of Trump or the election of Trump is very much tied into the narcissistic injuries of the public at large, that absent a space in this era of heightened polarizations, we see this kind of narrowing of possibility. And so in a very polarized world, there's none of the natural mechanisms for gaining a foothold in the world at large, a sense of power in the world, a feeling that one matters to the world, are available. What psychoanalysis shows is that when we narrow these gaps, when we elude or bypass a mediating space, which I'd like to refer to as a feminine space, but I'm sure we'll get to that, that we tend to organize identity in terms of a sense of identity, a loyalty to belonging based on a fierce attachment to a kind of reified and even caricatured sense of identity. And on the other hand, on the other side of that, we see a tendency towards simmering resentments and spite and vengeful fantasy, because there's no, again, if it's a human imperative to kind of claim a sense of value and mattering and inclusive belonging in society, when we don't have a space for that, we reduce ourselves to this fear of omnipotence.
So you see him as, in that sense, and his discourse as a symptom of a larger collapse of shared political space for working through problems, although there is, I suppose, always a potential in responding to what's going on now to romanticize an earlier era of so-called civil discourse when there have been so many people of color excluded, women excluded, who are now active and mobilized. So it's there are these paradoxes attached to what's going on now, as you have social movements mobilized and the Black Lives Matter movement, the Me Too movement. How do you, in your work, I know you have pursued an interesting line of argument in connecting some of the racism, I mean the blatant racism in his campaign questioning Obama's birth, and the anxiety that runs through a lot of his attacks on women, and how this the sexism and racism operating in his political discourse and his appeal, particularly to white men, have kind of go hand in hand. Can you say a bit about that? It may take more than a bit, but can you speak to that?
Well, I think this is, again, part of his uncanny brilliance and quite disturbing to most of us, because not only did Trump has Trump portrayed himself as above the law and unaccountable to the law or unaccountable to reality, he does so by exploiting what psychoanalysts might regard as our foundational fantasies from childhood. So children, according, let's go back to Freud for a moment, according to Freud, were preoccupied with some basic questions, which I think ran subtextually throughout the presidential campaign and eluded most analyses. So the child, and I think the public at large during this campaign, were, because of Trump's positing his birtherism charge against Obama, were preoccupied with this question of where did Obama come from and to what clan did he belong? They also would become preoccupied, because of Trump's rhetoric, with the deeply flawed, crooked Hillary versus the so big, so great, trumped up Donald. Now, these are questions of anatomical difference that are part and parcel of any analytic inquiry. And they cast, aided and abetted by Trump's narrative, the world as one of where people either win or lose. There's one winner among a field of losers. It's not a place that's inclusive where everybody has a piece of the pie. So we would become preoccupied with these, and this again operated unconsciously throughout the campaign. What did Trump have? We knew it was big and awesome, supposedly. And what was Hillary missing? Her inaccessible, right, her mind, her capacious contours were less easy to access or define, and ultimately became treated as degraded and inferior, as so often is the case for women in the public sphere. But we began to see how these gaps between these caricatured elements rooted in physical anatomy for Freud became operated in the public realm, in the public imagination, and bifurcated, right, the what was wrong with Hillary, the question of what Hillary was missing, that word flawed that came to be definitive of Hillary versus what the size that Trump wanted to project that he owned.
You've made, and we have to close in a moment, but you've made this point that much of what he circles around is the anxiety about our dependency on women, or perhaps our dependency even on Mother Africa, if you want to go there, that we all are descendants of some other place, of immigrants, and the disavowal of so many of the dependencies that we share. And so he circles around that problem.
So we see that the female body operated in this question about anatomy throughout the campaign, that although that from the get-go with Trump's bringing in the birtherist narrative, although mostly that's been analyzed in terms of race, we hear in the word itself, birth, the link to the unspoken female body, to the female vagina, to what gives birth, the awesome power of the feminine. And psychoanalysts have, yes, had a great deal to say about the power of the female body and also how the female body becomes degraded and a source of tremendous fear.
Yeah, and it's both real as in masculine and patriarchal power, but also, as you point out, becomes a domain of a fantasy and fear. So, well, Jill Gentile, it's time to close for today, but we will post on our website a link to your book and a recent article where people can read more about this, I think, really important line of critical analysis you present that goes beyond just diagnosing Trump in the usual ways it's become a parlor game. So thank you so much for being with us today. This is Jan Hocken talking with Jill Gentile about Trump and pathology on President's Day.
Thank you so much, Jan.
I cried when they shot John Lennon. Tears ran down my spine.
Well, hi, folks. That was Jello Biafra's version of Love Me, I'm a Liberal. Jello Biafra, he's still singing and talking. He was a big star in the punk scene in the 80s going into the 90s. Before hearing Jello Biafra's version of Love Me, I'm a Liberal, you heard Jan Hocken interview Jill Gentile on Trump. Her name is spelled Gentile. If you want to Google her articles. Before that, you heard Phil Elk's original song, Love Me, I'm a Liberal. And at the end of today's Old Mole, Jeff Hunt offers a commentary on punk rock's appreciation and use of 60s radical folk music. Also today, a clip from Fred Hampton talking revolution. Boots Riley does the instrumentation. Next on The Mole, I'm Bill Resnick, your host today. I interview Bob Peterson, a radical teacher. Bob Peterson, welcome to KABU.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Bob Peterson is a founding editor of the magazine Rethinking Schools and the Rethinking Schools Network. He taught many years at La Escuela Fraternity in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He recently served two terms as president of the Milwaukee Teachers Education Association. He describes himself in his blog titled Democracy in Education.
Right, that's correct.
I quote his blog, "Public education, the entire public sector, and democracy are under attack. As a teacher activist, I organize and write in favor of social justice teacher unionism, social justice teaching, and for the creation of a new social movement for economic and political democracy and racial justice." He's really active in that movement, and especially in the struggle to save public education from the billionaires and the privatizers and the voucher advocates and the right-wingers. Bob, tell us about that attack.
Well, the attack is strong and getting stronger, unfortunately. You know, it actually dates back to the 1950s and Milton Friedman, who proposed a voucher program for all. And after the Brown v. Board decision, which tried to desegregate the public schools, people actually started using vouchers right away to try to circumvent that in a couple places in the South. Since that time, basically, instead of fulfilling the dream of Brown v. Board and providing equal education to all children in this country, various groups of right-wingers, including the Americans for Prosperity, the American Federation for Children, that's the one associated with Betsy DeVos, the Milwaukee's Lynn and Harry Bradley Foundation and Walmart Foundation, et cetera, have seen the opportunity to make money and to ideologically destroy the public sector by attacking public schools.
And destroy the teachers' unions, who are one of the main impediments to their grand plan.
Absolutely. That's an auxiliary part of their plan. What we see is whether it's a privatized voucher program like we have in Wisconsin and D.C. and Cleveland, or privately run charter schools that have basically the charter school movement has been hijacked by privatizers in most places around the country, or various tax incentives, tax write-offs, what we see is a strong and growing movement to privatize schools. For example, in 2010, when the GOP started making gains in state houses across the country, there were 15 states in the District of Columbia that hosted 24 private school choice programs. 6 years later, in 2016, 28 states in D.C. had passed a total of 61 programs. And this continues to be on the rise. As we know, ALEC, which promotes template legislative initiatives, is one of the many groups behind that.
Lots of boy billionaires contribute, then. Eli Broad.
Absolutely.
There's all sorts of billionaires who have made destroying public education their hobby.
That's true.
And they put a huge amount of money into them. They've been exposed, but they're shameless. And in the process, of course, what they're doing is defunding public schools. Everywhere they get a foothold, they grab a lot of money, also use hedge fund or whatever money they can raise from. There's so many billionaires who will give a couple, 50 million, whatever, 20, 10,
right,
to actually spend a lot of money on those schools. And it's sort of a bait and switch program. They create schools that sort of look good, at least. In fact, they aren't very good, but it's destroying the public system because it's also taking public money and making it impossible to keep the system going. Then they have to begin closing schools. It erodes the public school system by this charter movement, it seems to me.
It's true, and that's a strategy for their attack on the entire public sector. You defund it, and then you show that there's some weaknesses, and there were already weaknesses in any society, obviously, especially our society that has racial, gender, class biases built within it. But instead of transforming and improving that public sector by defunding it, it makes it harder and harder for even basic services to be provided, and thus they can come in and claim that the schools are inherently ineffective and suggest a privatized solution. Now, what we see in Milwaukee and Wisconsin alone, $250 million a year goes from the public schools to privatized schools, most of which are religious schools in the private voucher program. And as we mentioned, a key component of politically winning this struggle by the right wing is to neuter and destroy and attack the public sector unions. And that's what's happened certainly here in Wisconsin. They've tried to do that, but obviously on a nationwide level, that's happening. And in fact, we can anticipate a Janus decision by the U.S. Supreme Court that will take away the right to get a fair share from active teachers in schools and thus further weaken the union.
Right.
This is all part of a grand plan to privatize the whole setup. And I maintain, and I think it's true, that we certainly have to defend public schools, and we have to admit that there's some weaknesses, and we have to transform them. But we much better to defend and transform than to defund and destroy, because the few students who benefit from the privatized schools are a few, whereas in all our communities, it is the public school system that has the capacity, commitment, and legal obligation to serve all children. You know, we can improve how we serve it, but we're the ones serving all children. We see that day in and day out. Privately run charter schools and private voucher schools, when they don't like a student in terms of behavior or academic achievement, they counsel them out. And where do they end up? In the public schools. So to me, it's surprising, in fact, that the charter schools and voucher schools don't do better.
Yeah, let's get into that. It's very surprising, since they do test prep, a lot of it. They get rid of all students who show signs of any kind of rebellion or who do poorly on tests. And yet, even on the tests they design, the public schools do equally well, at least.
Yes, that's true. It's only a fourth of the charter schools do it anywhere close to better or at level with the public schools. And I am always amazed. I mean, as a teacher for 25 years, I know if I can select my students, I'll get a pretty good achievement rate, no matter how we score it, you know, how we measure it.
Right.
And that's exactly what the charter schools and the voucher schools tend to do. When I say tend, it's not every single student, but it's those who are most difficult to educate, whether it's those who don't speak English as a first language, those who have special needs that need increased attention. So what happens is there's a growing percentage of those students in the public schools as charter schools and voucher schools take more of a percentage of the total student population in any particular city.
Yeah, it's really insidious. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole. I'm talking to Bob Peterson, who helped found Rethinking Schools and the Rethinking Schools Network, and we have an active chapter here in Portland, Oregon. Bob taught in Milwaukee. We are talking about the fight to stop the privatizers and maintain public education and improve public education at the same time. What's your sense of why charter schools and privatizers and that whole apparatus, with all the advantages they have, including more money, including being able to kick out a lot of kids, how is it that they do so poorly?
Well, clearly one of the issues is, in many schools, the leadership and the quality of the staff that they employ. I mean, one of the main differences between a private-run charter school and a voucher school and the public schools is that the teachers don't have just cause, they, in the sense of dismissal, or they're at the whim of the principal or the director, whoever that may be. And we see in Milwaukee, for instance, on a regular basis, teachers trying to get out of charter and voucher schools and get into the public school system. Despite the problems of public schools, they feel more secure. They feel that there is more of a team effort on the part of teachers working together and not as dictatorial of a framework as some private institutions have. So I think that's one thing. I think it's also just important to understand that these schools really, I mean, with, again, with some exceptions, are run by some people who are looking just for self-aggrandizement or quite frankly, to make some money off the deal. You look at some of the salaries of the principals in our voucher schools in Milwaukee or in Wisconsin and the charter schools. You also see a connection between charter schools like Rocket Ship, it's a national chain, and the software that and the software companies that some of the boards of directors, members of the board of directors of a school like Rocket Ship have. And so they can make a fair amount of money off of both the software. And then, as you mentioned previously, some of the hedge fund folks are making money off of real estate in places, especially places like New York City. So it's complicated, but the bottom line is the people behind most of these schools in it for a reason other than what public school educators are in the profession for.
There's also such huge turnover in the schools, but it takes a while for people to learn how to develop all of the pedagogies, the personal habits, the ways of relating, the curriculums, to become a good teacher, and they need a lot of help from other teachers. That's one of the things. The teacher unions protect teachers. They make time to collaborate. Many of them now are adopting the idea and, in fact, fulfilling it, that we stand for the schools your children deserve. Diane Ravitch, who was a furious voucher supporter until she saw what she had helped create, and then was mortified and began recognizing all of the virtues of the teachers' union and public education, and has been playing that, making those arguments for a long time. It seems to me there's so much to be said now for the kinds of teachers that are being developed versus the vouchers who people leave after 2, 3, 5 years. They can't take it anymore.
In fact, the whole system of the Teach for America, and I'm nothing against the young college students who go into that program, but the fact is that it's part and parcel of the same plan. Basically, de-skilling teachers, thinking, well, you can just, you know, get 6 weeks of early worth of training to follow the scripted test-driven curriculum and work your butt off, and then after 2 years you go on. And that's what happens to a lot of those teachers, and a lot of those teachers are placed in charter and voucher schools. And so you have the turnover that you're referring to.
What's going to happen? Let's say the charter school, a horrible dystopic outcome, it seems to me. They weaken the public school system sufficiently that they're then become easy for them just to knock it down and create this free market paradise in education. It seems to me that what we would get is exactly what we have in sort of semi-free market child care, the nursing home and elder system, where 5 or 10% of the population, where 1% gets anything they want, right? And often it's good, where the net top 10% has enough money to do fairly well. And then it starts going down, and the bottom rung of child care in this country, not because of the workers, but they're extremely low paid, so they don't stay around very long and get very little help. But at the bottom rung, they get terrible systems, and in nursing homes, it causes early death. What we have are these systems that work on the market. They're free market systems, mostly. And the schools will resemble it. Private capital is not interested in the bottom half of the population. They sell to the top 25% and maybe 50%. And after that, the future of education in this country that they're driving for is exactly that.
Len, I think we're seeing this come true in different cities. You take New Orleans, which has basically been privatized, and there's horrific stories coming out of the real failure to deal with any student with special needs, and charter schools closing overnight and people having to scurry to find a place for their children to go to school the following days and weeks. You have Detroit, Chicago, Milwaukee, which have been severely defunded because of the massive amounts of money that's gone into charter schools in Detroit and Chicago, and especially voucher schools here in Milwaukee. As I said, we have over 120 voucher schools in Milwaukee taking nearly $200 million a year from public funding for the public schools. And the public schools have been hurt by budget cuts and this shift of money, funneling of money into private schools. So you larger class sizes, less arts, music, physical education, and so on and so forth. And it's spiraling out of control. And this is exactly what the current president and the secretary of education, Betsy DeVos, want. They want a completely voucherized, privatized school system, and it will be a disaster both in terms of those who need public schools the most, but for every child, because there will be no public scrutiny of what takes place in these schools. There's no democratic control. It's an attack on democracy because these schools do not have anybody who is democratically elected running them. Obviously, democracy is a work in progress, and I think we have to work as if we live in democracy, struggle for that. But at the lowest level, the school boards historically have been probably one of the more democratic institutions amongst our representative system. And these people are being replaced by privatized boards, like at charter schools in Milwaukee. A lot of them, even though they're concentrated in the city, the board of directors live in the suburbs. It's ridiculous. It's an attack. It's something that anybody who believes in democracy and justice should oppose.
One final thing, Bob Peterson of Rethinking Schools. You should check Rethinking Schools Journal and Portland. Get in touch with Portland Rethinking Schools if you're interested. And then the Teachers Union here, which has really become an active social justice organization recently. Bob, give us a little plug for getting active in the schools and supporting public education and how to do it.
Absolutely. Well, it depends. Obviously, if you're an educator, you do get involved in your union and other social justice organizations that are involved with teachers. But also, it's so important, if you're a teacher, to reach out to parents and community groups to push your union to do so. As you said, the Portland Association of Teachers is on the road to doing that and doing a great job, I think, from what I hear. And if you're a parent, not only come to your child's school and try to get involved in the leadership, but don't only look out for your child's school. Look out for all public schools and to work in organizations to both decrease the reliance on standardized testing and scripted curriculum, the promotion of project-based active learning, and the legislation which is necessary to both fund those kind of things, smaller class sizes, better professional development, extracurricular activities, wraparound school programs, community school initiatives, those kinds of things. We have to build an education justice movement to demand and ultimately win at the levels of school board, state legislatures, and a national level.
Bob Peterson, Rethinking Schools, very good talking to you. Thanks a lot.
Great talking to you. You take care.
Sure, once I was young and impulsive, I wore every conceivable pin. Even went to socialist meetings, learned all the old union hymns. Ah, but I've grown older and wiser, and that's why I'm turning you in. So love me, love me, love me.
Oh, yes, lots of applause for Phil Oakes. That was the last verse of his anthem, Love Me, I'm a Liberal. Before that, I talked to Bob Peterson. To find writing by Bob, check out his blog and the website Rethinking Schools, the magazine. Stay tuned on The Mole for review of a novel inspiring for radicals. It's called A Sudden Light. Also a discussion of punk rock and their appropriation of 60s radical rock. Next on The Mole, Fred Hampton. It's a recording of the speech. Fred Hampton, who's a Black Panther organizer, a gifted speaker, was in fact assassinated by a combination of the FBI and the Chicago police, who broke into his apartment and then sprayed machine gun bullets into Fred Hampton's bedroom and killed another person as well, injured his wife, and to finish. In any event, introduced by Fran Michelle.
Greetings, Moles. The news is so appalling these days, I don't even know where to begin. The federal budget proposal from the Trump administration proposed replacing food stamps with a monthly American Harvest box full of government-picked non-perishable foods like milk, peanut butter, canned fruits, and cereal. The proposal, of course, made no provision for people allergic to peanuts or wheat, and because it would replace aid from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, that would reduce the access recipients have to fresh fruits and vegetables. In addition to making major cuts in SNAP, the Trump budget proposal would make major cuts in Section 8 housing assistance, in Medicare, in Medicaid, in the National Science Foundation, the Army Corps of Engineers, the Labor Department, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Chemical Safety Board, tasked with investigating accidents at chemical facilities. Meanwhile, in the Northwest, another spread of radioactive contamination from Hanford's plutonium reclamation facility. In other news, which will be getting even harder to find because of the repeal of net neutrality rules, the current administration is backing off of enforcing existing regulations and laws. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has dropped a lawsuit against a lender that allegedly charged people up to 950% interest rates because the suit doesn't fit the Bureau's revised mission. The Education and Justice Departments withdrew the Obama-era guidance on transgender restroom access, so the Education Department will not be responding to any complaints filed by transgender students who are banned from restrooms that match their gender identity. And the House passed H.R. 620 that places significant obstacles to enforcement of the Americans with Disabilities Act, basically allowing companies to defer accommodations until months after anyone has brought a suit against them. In Florida, we had the 18th school shooting of 2018, which killed 17 people. The 19-year-old shooter was a white supremacist. I don't even know where to start. Talk with your neighbors. Join an organization. I'm turning it over to the archival Fred Hampton.
And why they want to get rid of me, because I'm saying something that might wake up some other exploited people and some other oppressed people, and if all these people ever get together, then these pigs that are exploiting us, we'll be able to run them into the lake. That's why they want to get rid of us. What makes them mad about it is that they had black people and white poor people and red poor people and Puerto Rican poor people and Latin American Puerto Rican people poor people of all descents. They had them caught up in movements based on racism when the Black Panther Party stood up and said that we don't care what anybody says. We don't think you fight fire with fire best. We think you fight fire with water best. We're going to fight racism, not with racism, but we're going to fight it with solidarity. We said we're not going to fight capitalism with black capitalism, but we're going to fight it with socialism. We stood up and said we're not going to fight reactionary pigs and reactionary state's attorneys like this and reactionary state's attorneys like Hanrahan with any other reactions on our part. We're going to fight their reactions with all of us people to get together and have an international proletarian revolution.
Right on.
And that's saying all power to the people.
Right on.
That's saying that no matter what color you are, there's only two classes. And that's saying there's a class over here and there's a class over there. And the reason that this class over here has never did anything to get this class off its back, because this is lower, this is upper. This is the oppressed, this is the oppressor. This is the exploited, this is the exploiter. And these people in this class have divided themselves. They say, I'm black and I hate white people. I'm white and I hate black people. I'm Latin American and I hate hillbillies. I'm hillbillies, I hate Indians. So we fight amongst each other. And you've heard the testimony of pigs here. You got pigs of all colors, you know that. You got pigs that are white, you got pigs that are black, you even got pigs that are black and white. Propagating the same type of madness that this buffoon Hanrahan would be propagating if he were here himself. And why? Because they want to keep you to believing that I'm your enemy, and that everybody else that's black and that wears a lot of hair on his head and hair on his face, they want to keep you thinking that he's your enemy. Why? Because if ever you would disregard him and overlook him just for a minute and throw away that question of racism and started to dealing with a little logic, then there would be no one else you could attack other than Hanrahan, other than Daly, and other than Tricky Dicky Nixon. If you make the right decision, then the oppressed people of the world will get complete satisfaction.
So we say, we always say to Black Panther Party that they can do anything they want to us. We might not be back. I might be in jail. I might be anywhere. But when I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am the people. I'm not the pig. You've got to make a distinction. And the people are going to have to attack the pig. The people are going to have to stand up against the pig. That's what the Panthers do, and that's what the Panthers do all over the world.
Okay, well, I apologize. I misannounced. That last piece was introduced by Fran Michel, our old mole, and it was Fred Hampton. That was an archival footage of Fred Hampton Sr. assassinated by the Chicago police. So, where are we in the show now? Let's go directly now to our literary mole, Larry Bolden. He reviews a novel of optimism, hope, inspiration, good for these hard times, Garth Stein's book, A Sudden Light.
Good morning. Garth Stein begins his intriguing novel, A Sudden Light, with a quote from Anais Nin. We do not see things the way they are, we see them as we are. And with this Kantian insight, he begins to tell a long story that calls into question the reliability of memory, the responsibilities of wealth, and the destruction of the forests of this country by the lumber barons of the 19th and 20th centuries. Most of you readers will know Stein by his famous novel, The Art of Racing in the Rain, and while that was a fine book, I think this one is better and more important. Trevor Holloway, who is 14 years old, goes on a trip to Seattle with his father in order to discover about his past and about the vast estate once owned by his great-great-grandfather, Elijah Riddell. Trevor's parents, Jones and Rachel, have recently separated after Jones' business has collapsed and his mother has escaped to England to be with her family. While he is not sure why his father has insisted that he accompany him on the trip, he is sure of what his personal mission is. Quote, I understood two things. First, somewhere along the way, my father had gone wrong, and my mother stopped loving him. Second, I could fix him. I could pull him together. And I believed that by the end of the summer, if I did my job right, I could deliver my father to my mother as if he were a regular loving person, like when she first met him. And then, well, then it would be up to her to decide where her heart lay. A kid can only do so much. Close quote. During the course of his summer, he meets his 73-year-old grandfather, Grandpa Samuel, who's said to be suffering from dementia, and his beautiful aunt, Serena, who feels that her brother Jones simply abandoned her when she was 11, but now has come back to save her by getting their father to sell the huge old mansion they still live in and the extensive grounds that are worth a fortune given the proximity to the city of Seattle. He also learns that Elijah was one of the major timber barons who, according to his dead son Ben, destroyed nature for profit. Ben is the conservationist son who bends all of his efforts to saving the North Estate and returning at least that small part of the forest back to nature. The story is a long and intricate one, and you'll have to discover its many turns by reading the book yourself. But I can say that you will be reminded of another forester, Pinchot or Pinchot, and of the great conservationist John Muir. The book reminded me in a powerful way of my fascination with Muir in the 70s and sent me back to some of his work. Trevor comes to know Ben through his dreams and comes to believe that he is somehow channeling Ben and joining him in the struggle to preserve a bit of the land Ben's father acquired. Trevor slowly explores many of the hidden rooms and chambers of the huge mansion and pieces together a story of the house's past and of the sins of his forefathers. Grandpa Samuel provides the first clues about the past and the struggles he's having with his daughter Serena over selling the house and land. Serena has essentially surrendered her own life in the service of her aging father, and she wants finally to reap some benefit from the caretaking of the house and Samuel. We come to learn that her love for her brother, Jones, is not simply sisterly love, but has a romantic and even a carnal aspect as well. Indeed, her long-term plan is to get power of attorney so she and Jones can sell the land off to be parceled into plots for McMansions, and then to tour the world with Jones as her brother lover. Serena even tries to seduce young Trevor as an aid to completing her plans. While the story totally caught my interest, I was even more interested in the history provided of the rape of the land by the timber barons and the collusion between the timbermen and the mighty new railroads in exploiting the land for profit. While that history is certainly a sad and disturbing one, there is light in this story and some lovely excursions into nature mysticism as well. While some readers may be put off by the aura of magic in the novel, I read it more like a struggle between head and heart, between hard logic and a relationship with nature that transcends the need to codify and understand. Much like Ian McEwan's Black Dogs, in which I believe McEwan presents his own struggles to rectify the division between rationality and spirit, I believe this is Stein's attempt to take on this same struggle. There is, in the incomprehensible complexity of the universe, mystery that is not to be solved, but simply to be embraced. And Stein does a fine job of standing before and embracing the mystery. I came away from the book feeling more optimistic about the world, even in this dark and chaotic time, and I carried from it a quote from John Muir that has become a sort of mantra for me. "My peace I give unto you." When you read the book, you will understand the importance of the mantra. I've been talking about Garth Stein's 2014 novel, A Sudden Light. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Once I was young and had an attitude, stickers covered the car I drove in. Even went on some direct actions when there weren't rent-a-cops to be seen. But now I've grown older and wiser, and that's why I'm turning you in. So love me, love me, love me. Love me, love me, love me. Love me, love me, love me. I'm a hero.
Yes, that was Jello Biafra, his version of Love Me, I'm a Liberal by Phil Oakes, the original. He used his own words as well, but similar themes. The music today, both the first verse of both versions and the last verse, congratulations, Jeffrey Huntry, for choosing them. It's a that's a lead-in to... he's in the studio today to talk to us. Jeffrey, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Hunt is a Renaissance man and an engineer who repairs old audio equipment, who's also a political, knows music. Jeff, we played those first verse and the last verse of both Phil Oakes' original and then Jello Biafra's version, actually from the early 1990s. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the dead Biafra and the dead Kennedys and their relation to Phil Oakes and the radical folk revival of the 60s.
Yeah, well, you know, Jello Biafra with his band, the Dead Kennedys, were active late 70s into the 80s, but when Jello Biafra was growing up in his home, his parents were folkies and jazz listeners, and that's the music he grew up with, and that's kind of the world he set out into as a young man, and, you know, he carried out these themes into... throughout the whole Dead Kennedys catalog, really, progressively more so over time.
And how did he encounter Phil Oakes's work?
Yeah, actually, I encountered him through that song, Love Me, I'm Liberal. A pen pal and a friend of mine at age 13, somewhere in the early 90s, sent me a cassette in the mail with Jello Biafra and Mojo Nixon's version of Love Me, I'm a Liberal. And in his letter that he wrote, he explained the song, who it came from, and... that was new to me at age 12 or 13 or something.
Uh-huh. But the music you listened to a lot was Jello Biafra. You know, I was, of course, alive back then, mm-hmm. and the punk scene always sort of irritated my ears, and I really mm-hmm. didn't. I was still living, of course, the great ballads by Bob Dylan and so many, many others of my youth.
And punk rock is the music that kills houseplants.
Oh yes, is that the joke?
That's what I heard.
Oh yes, well, my houseplants didn't get a neighbor. I took good care of
my
them.
My plants are thriving.
Anyway, where were we in this interview? Yeah, Jello Biafra, though, you know, I always dismissed him, actually. I mean, he was he was a really big punk star, and the Dead Kennedys. Mm-hmm. And I dismissed both of them, like the Dead Kennedys. Sort of horror. We're being pushed off the air in two minutes.
Goodness.
Okay, so explain.
When the Dead Kennedys first started out, it was a reaction to the kind of fun, sort of snotty, prankstery music coming out of England in the late 70s. It was an imitation of that, so to say, sort of like a Me Too sort of statement. But in the, I would say after like the third album, the songwriting really matured. The band matured as musicians as well, but the lyrics were just incredible. You know, they published all the albums with the lyrics in the liner notes, and I would sit and read them, and there were pages and pages, really.
Of sort of political discussion in some ways, but
yeah,
but,
and he would name check different people, you know, like Huey Newton, Angela Davis, you know, Governor Jerry Brown was a big one. And like, who are these people? Said 12-year-old me, and I went to the library, and then I read all of Abbie Hoffman's books, for example, thanks to the Dead Kennedys as well.
Yeah, very serious. His name just put me off.
And
because Biafra was a tragedy, actually.
It was to comment on the cheapness of it all, I guess you could say.
Yeah. It was good for being a punk, but it wasn't good for really crossing over a lot to the those people who still nurtured and admired is even too less, there's a stronger word for what it was. But in any event,
Contemporaries were named things like Johnny Rotten or Doug Graves or something like that.
Oh, right. Anyway, those albums, those middle albums for the Dead Kennedys, they were really terrific, I gather. And maybe we should play more of them, actually, on the air.
I'd like to do that.
And give them a revival. Anyway, we have to end this interview. Thank you very much, Jeffrey.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
We'll do more of it. I have to sign off now, and I have a minute to do it. I just want to thank everybody who's on the show, and thanks to all of you out there who support this station. If you're not now a member or want to make a nice gift, well, you'll be welcome to KABU, the KABU website. Please support our winter fundraising Kickstarter campaign. We're the breath of life in Portland media. Help us keep Portland weird. Just push the buttons on your computer, your laptop, your smartphone, or whatever else they may develop. You punch the buttons for KBOO.FM/Kickstarter, all one long sort of run-on word. Anyway, thanks for listening today, folks. Those run-on words, you don't want to stay away from them, actually. And that's all for the Old Mole. I'm signing off.